Good evening. I'm Ray Hill. You're listening to Texas Execution Watch. This is radio station KPFT HD Channel 2. And every time someone is executed in Huntsville, Texas, we come into the studio and we do a one-hour program about that execution and the issue in general. We change and adapt to meet the particular situation, and tonight we have what is known as a volunteer. The fellow's name is Michael Anthony Rodriguez, 38 years old. He was one of the seven escapees from the Connolly unit, and during their escape, they wound up killing a police officer near Dallas, and he is the first of the survivors of that. One fellow committed suicide as the police was moving in, and the rest of them are scheduled to be executed. We are dealing with the execution of Michael Rodriguez first because he asked that all appeals cease, and he is faced with the trip to death row tonight. Glory, are you on standby in Huntsville?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, tell us what's going on there.
Well, the chimes just went off, so I guess it's 6 o'clock, and they actually started a few minutes early tonight. About 2 minutes before 6, the media walked in. It wasn't apparent that any witnesses, well, actually, I take that back. I think I saw Irene Wilcox. So at least a spiritual advisor is going in.
That's Irene Wilcox of the Salvation Army.
No. Wait. That's Catherine Cox.
Catherine Cox, okay.
Irene is another woman that ministers to men on death row.
Okay.
I think she and her husband both do. But the situation in Huntsville is very interesting. On the other end of the block, there's dozens and dozens of police officers, and apparently TDC put up some tents for them to stand under, so they're not in the sun like we are.
Okay.
They've got extra security here. They've got a group of, what are they called? Texas Department of Criminal Justice, Office of the Inspector General Police, who wear khaki pants and guns and belts with badges around their waist.
Is that different from usual?
Yeah. There's usually a couple of these people. Tonight there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 that I can see right in front of me who are here. And them, along with the gray shirts that are here, all wearing royal blue ribbons. I can't tell what it says, but I'm sure it's something about loving a cop. There's also about 50 to 100 people on motorcycles that have circled the Walls unit a couple of times, and I haven't seen them for about 20 minutes, so I'm assuming they're down at the other end with the cops. I don't know who the motorcyclists are, probably the same people that were out in Pasadena supporting Joe Horn with their loud noise.
Well,
and there's about 6 satellite trucks in the parking lot.
Lots of media.
KHOU 11 from Houston is here, but I see another 11 news, so I'm assuming that's Dallas, and it looks Fox, Dallas, Fort Worth. CW 33 from Dallas, Fort Worth.
Compared to Tuesday, that's an awful lot of media.
Yeah, there is a lot of media, and I guess it's because of the fact that a cop was killed. And this is the first of the Texas 7. There's only 6 of them alive, and so I guess there's 5 more on death row waiting for their execution. And they were... that case isn't that old. I can't remember what year they escaped. Was it like maybe 3 or 4 years ago?
Yeah, it was not very long ago when the escape actually occurred. In the current, it was December of 2000, actually.
December of what?
2000.
2000. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this execution, I think, as you mentioned, is taking place because Michael Rodriguez has given up his appeals.
Right.
The other interesting thing about this is that Michael Rodriguez didn't shoot anybody, and a week from tonight, Jeff Wood is scheduled for execution. He also did not shoot anybody. So you've got 2 cases of the law of parties within a week, which is I think, a horrific thing to be happening.
Well, I think we got some discussion later in the program, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut away and put you on standby. If anything happens, you can call Elizabeth's cell phone, and we'll get you on as quickly as we can.
Okay, great.
Thanks. You, Gloria.
All right, thank you.
And that was Gloria Rubach, who is our reporter in Huntsville. And Gloria frequently makes these trips up there to cover what's going on there. She is a member of one of the abolition groups here, and we'll be giving you information about them before the end of the program. In the studio with me is J.C. Mosier, and J.C. and I have been friends for a good many years. At least I consider us friends, J.C.
I do, too.
And J.C., let me get you a microphone here. And J.C. is currently with Constable Abercy's office, where he is the assistant chief. And you've been a homicide detective. And you've been a police officer for a few years.
Yes, I have 41 years, as a matter of fact, 25 with HPD, and now I'm sort of working into my 18th year with Harris County. And 8 or 9 of those years at HPD were as an investigator in the homicide division.
Well, you're familiar because of your experience with the culture of police officers, professional culture, the milieu in which police officers live. This case deals with the murder of a police officer by escapees. What strikes you about that?
Well, there are probably a lot of things that a person would wonder, and then you wonder, the police would wonder how in the world they could get out of prison, first of all, how in the world they were able to do as much as they were able to do in the time that they were out, and a horrible thing with an officer who hears a call go out and actually is reading a little earlier, I think was out with his wife that night at dinner, heard a call go and left the restaurant to go to the, I think, Oshman store at that time that they were burglarizing. 29-year-old rookie officer. And,
just a kid.
Just a kid, yeah, really in the business, certainly.
Christmas Eve.
Yeah, that's right, Christmas Eve. Couldn't have any more horrible aspects to a night, I guess, than this. But I think what officers look at, and we are a brotherhood and sisterhood, no question about that, like perhaps no other. And we believe in taking care of each other. And we, when one of us hurts, we all hurt. And that's the way it is. When something like this happens to a police officer, it affects all of us. You always, to some degree, go there, but for the grace of God, go I. And it was a horrible thing, and certainly horrible in the way it was done. He was pretty much ambushed before he could even get out of his car. They shot several times through the windshield, then drug him out of the car and shot him several more times while he was down on the ground, and I think 6 times in the head. This was such an egregious act of violence, and it happens to the person, a police officer, who is supposed to stand in line to keep citizens, the good citizens, from having something happen to them. We always think, our group always thinks, that if a person will kill a police officer, he is at that point, desperate point, where no matter who gets in his way, they're apt to be killed. And if he'll kill a police officer, he'll kill any of us.
And this happened during the robbery of an Oshman store in the greater Dallas area.
Yeah, that's correct.
The officer drove up. Actually, probably didn't know what was going on before he was already victimized.
Probably had really no idea what was going on. At that point, it was happening so quickly, it would seem that a call could have gone out simply on a possible burglary of a building, of the building. Well, that in itself doesn't make you think that there's going to be a lot of violence occurring or a violent act. You got thieves. You got people trying to steal something. That's what you'd think as an officer. And he probably rode down there thinking, probably somebody trying to steal something out of the Oshman's. Maybe no big deal. But, of course, it turned out to be a big deal for him.
Thinking about your career, how many times were you that close to being vulnerable?
A lot of times. Every officer has times when he is very vulnerable. And many times where you go, Whew, thank you, Lord. This could have been a whole lot worse than it was. It happens to all officers that are out there. If you're out on the streets of a big city long enough as a police officer, you're going to have a lot of close calls. And it's something that we train officers, and we try to train them, that every person you stop on traffic is a potential killer. And that's the way you have to look at it.
Could the dispatcher have known enough about this to have made additional cautions?
Probably not. From what I understand, it happened pretty quickly. He heard the call on his radio and was probably very close to the area, which is why he would have left his family to go down there. He obviously was very close to the Oshmans, and probably did not have a lot of information, because normally the first kind of a call you get like that, someone sees someone and they believe they're in a building or perhaps burglarizing it, and they call and say, there's some strange people in this building or strange people hanging around this building. I think they're trying to steal something. And that's probably all he had to work with, possible burglary or a possible theft.
And this is Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve, yeah.
And they had no way of knowing that the people involved in their small town near Dallas were escapees from a Texas penitentiary.
Probably not. And certainly the officer, I'm sure, did not.
J.C. Mosier, thank you for coming down and sharing your thoughts with us on this sad occasion. And it's sad for everybody.
It is. The thing I used to always tell people on these cases, capital cases, you have a person obviously going to lose their life. They're going to be put to death. But you've always got two families that are going to be destroyed.
At least
someone is killed, and now their family, to a great, great degree, is being destroyed. The person who commits an act, to a great, great degree, his family, who had nothing to do with the act that he committed, they're going to be, to a great degree, destroyed. So there's nothing good out of any of this.
Nothing good out of it. Thank you, J.C. Mosier, for joining us. I'm Ray Hill with Texas Execution Watch, and we'll be right back in just a minute.
Shine on me. Shine on me. Let your light from your light out shine.
And we're back. Lo and behold, my name is Ray Hill. We're at Texas Execution Watch. J.C. Mosier just left. He's the assistant chief in Jack Abercy's office, Constable Precinct 1. Billy Sinclair has joined us again for this program. Billy, as you will... Well, Billy, just tell them your story.
Well, I spent 40 years in the Louisiana prison system. And
6.5 of those years were spent on death row. And
the Green Mine.
Yeah, and you know, the era I was on death row was certainly pre-Furman. The pre-reinstatement death penalty in 1976 and pre-Furman in 1972. So I was on death row during a period of time where there was sort of a national unwritten moratorium on the death penalty. And one of the things that's interesting in the Rodriguez case is the fact that he is elected to put himself to death.
Call them volunteers in the vernacular. Is that normal in Louisiana, too?
Well, I saw it one time when I was on death row. A gentleman tried to, he waived all his appeals and asked to be put to death. And there was probably one, maybe two media reports about it. But during that era, the right to die, the right to volunteer for death, did not exist.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't even have a right. You had a right to have your case reviewed, but there were many inmates on death row, particularly in Louisiana and other states, whose direct appeals were never taken to the courts. They just sat there and languished on death row unless their case had some kind of particular local interest that forced the local officials to push for a death date or push for the individual's execution. So a lot of men just languished on death row without any appeals ever being taken. So there was not an issue, I'm going to waive my right to appeal and force the state to to execute me.
That wasn't happening.
No, that became a phenomenon in 1976 when Gary Gilmore, you know, first person executed after death.
And Gary was among what we would call a volunteer.
Exactly. Right? He started, and my personal opinion on it is that if you look at the Rodriguez case, the man is 38 years old.
Yeah.
He committed a crime that right now, if his sentence were commuted to life, he would spend the rest of his natural life in prison. So we're talking about, let's say he lives to be 78, and that's about the medium age range for a male in America today. So that would be 40 more years that he would spend in prison in addition to what he has already served on death row. And so you have a lot of inmates, and some of them will do it by suicide. Some of them will elect to say, I'm not going to deal with this life sentence. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in prison. So, you know, I'm going to commit suicide. There's some on death row who say, no, I'm going to force the state to take my life. They sentence me to death. I'm going to force them to go through the process, to go through the procedure, and take my life. I think that's every man's right. I think every man has a right to make that decision when he's facing the rest of his life in prison. And I think the only way I subscribe to the death penalty, the only way I subscribe to the death penalty, if the state of Texas or any other state for that matter tells an individual, you have a choice. We will give you life without the benefit of parole. You're never, ever getting out of prison. And believe me, life in any state prison today, life is not mercy.
No.
There's no quality of mercy in the prison existence in any prison in these United States, in any state, in any country. So if a person elects to say, well, I'll pick the death penalty, then the state should carry out its legal obligations and put the man to death.
Well, I don't think that folks look at it that way. I think that the revenge folks want to kill them, and they prefer that they don't want to die.
Exactly.
And so committing suicide with the state's needle is certainly the statistically most expensive way to do that.
Yeah, it is. And you're depriving people who seek your death. There are a lot of people up there at Huntsville right now who want this man dead, who wanted this man dead the moment that the crime happened. So there's a lot of people who crave revenge in these kind of cases. And want to have it and demanding it and expect it. And Rodriguez has taken some of the, if you want to use the term, quality of their revenge away from him because he's depriving him. He's saying, you know, your revenge doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
I'm gonna die in his way of thinking, I'm gonna die like a man. I'm gonna die at my own choosing, at my own time. The state of Texas might pick the date, and they might pick the time that they're gonna start to pour the chemicals into my body, but I'm going to choose how I'm going to die, and I'm going to make the state of Texas do what it sentenced me to do, which is to be executed.
And that gives him more control than, say, the average person who's putting up a struggle through the courts and through the appeals and through the clemency process.
Yeah, there's only three ways you can accept execution. You can have them drag you, crying and screaming bloody murder, into the death chamber. You can accept it with some kind of benign acceptance that you have no control over it. You know, there's nothing that can be done. Maybe perhaps hoping up to the last minute that a stay or something will stop this process. Or you can say, I'm going to walk in there as a man. I'm going to choose to die as a man. The state of Texas, and particularly those people who want to see me die, might not agree with what I'm doing. But I'm going to die on my own terms and my own way. And I think that's what Michael Rodriguez is doing tonight.
Billy Sinclair, I asked J.C. Mosier, who is from a culture of police officers and all of that, how his culture reacted when somebody like this was executed. And I'm asking you, from your experience and culture on death row and in Louisiana prisons, what does that culture think about these times?
I think some of the inmates on death row, not a lot of them. It depends upon the individual. If Michael Rodriguez is a strong man and has a strong set of his own values, whether you agree with those values or not, if he carries himself where the inmates know or consider him a man, they're not going to tell him anything. But there will be some that will feel, hey, he's bringing attention to the death penalty. He's putting me in jeopardy because, you know, he's going out here asking to be put to death. That only stirs up pro-death penalty feelings all the more. So there's some of them that resent it. I'm sure that after these guys escaped, just like some time ago you had escape off Texas death row, and following that escape, they put them in extreme lockdown.
The Garulli escape. I was actually in Huntsville when that come down.
And they put them in extreme lockdown. And you, I'm sure you had inmates that resented that deeply, but it depends upon the individuals who did the act, whether or not anybody is going to balls up and go tell them anything about it or express their discontent or displeasure with what they're doing. I would venture a guess that there were very few people on death row in Huntsville in the last few days or the last few months that expressed any displeasure to Michael Rodriguez.
Really?
Yeah.
I was there when Garulli's escape come down. Actually, I was there with Amy Goodman, KPFT's ace national news reporter. We went up there to cover the execution of a Canadian. That didn't happen. He got a stay for some reason or other, and Amy and I were driving through the woods, and Garulli escaped. And so we went from there through the East Texas back roads, stopping every few feet for a search of our car. And he died that night. But the guys on the death row that communicated with me said at least he died a free man, meaning he made it over that fence before he was shot and subsequently died. And it appeared in my correspondence that they respected that.
Yeah, I think most of them respect the fact that that any resistance of the authority that is set to kill you, whether it's through escape or even through accepted, like you say, volunteer death penalty, whatever the method is, I think that by and large most of the inmates that are in that kind of situation can accept and understand that.
For those of you just joining, this is a conversation between Billy Sinclair and your sometimes host, Ray Hill, and we're talking about the execution of Michael Anthony Rodriguez, 38 years old. He's born in San Antonio, Texas. He was apparently a business guy seeking. He worked for a fast food restaurant and decided, hey, if I had enough money, I could do this on my own, and he got started. And we're going to be talking with Jim Skelton a little later in the program about this guy and the background of not just the case for which he's being executed tonight, but we're going to talk about the case that got him in prison in the first place. He was in prison, sentenced to life, destined to probably spend most of it in prison, and he and his peers in the maintenance department decided they wanted to escape. Is that how you got it, Jim?
Oh, yeah.
What is your impression?
Let me tell you the thing that struck me, first off, several things struck me as real interesting. Number one, we should give some serious consideration on our idea of being that harsh in punishment, because the guy who led this was a guy named George Reeves, serving 18 life sentences. He had no hope of getting out of the pen. This guy was serving a life sentence. These long, harsh sentences with no hope, you create a group of people who have absolutely nothing to lose, and they become extremely dangerous. And it is, and I think it's very dangerous for people that work in prisons, because if you've got nothing left to lose, you have no hope of getting out, no carrot to dangle in front of you. You're pretty much out of control. Because everyone involved in this case had received extremely long sentences. The ringleader, George Rebus, like I said, had 18 life sentences, 17, and one of them was stacked. So he had nothing to lose.
No way.
So when you start handling these real harsh sentences, these redneck kiddies better figure out that you're creating a dangerous situation. You're creating a group of people who have absolutely nothing to lose and will take any chance they can to escape and kill anybody. That's the first thing that struck me. We better do some real serious thought how we sentence people. Second thing that really struck me, I wish J.C. had hung around Lodi, I was going to ask him about this. The thing that really struck me about this case when I was getting it ready to put on the show, these guys get out of prison. When they subdued guys in the maintenance department and stripped their clothes off and got their identification, subdued a guy in a in a guard tower, subdued several guards. They never beat or abused any of the people at TDC that had been their guards, who had worked with them every day.
Sure.
They tied them up. They didn't slap them around. They didn't kick them. They didn't abuse them. They leave the prison, go to San Antonio, because George Rodriguez's father had left a car. He and a woman had taken a car up there and left some money and put the keys in the tailpipe. And they go to San Antonio and spend the night. They need money. They go to Pearland. Now, here's what I find to be real interesting. They go to Pearland and decide to rob a radio shack. Now, what George Rivas had done, he was kind of the master, well, it wasn't kind of, he was a mastermind behind this. Rivas goes in, what he had done before in robberies, he goes in just at closing time. And several of his cohorts go inside the store, and they rob all the customers. And here's what's ironical. During this robbery, one of the guys who he was robbing said, can I have my keys back? I need my keys. And the robber and the guy said, sure, no problem, gave the keys back. Another guy
with
said,
his fingerprints on it and everything.
Well, he made sure he didn't have his fingerprints. Okay. Because the same guy asked for his credit cards. And the guy took the edge of him. He didn't make sure his fingerprints were on. He handed the credit card back to this customer. They didn't slap. They didn't hurt. Didn't touch anybody. During the robbery, there was a young man managing the Radio Shack store. His father drives up to take him home. Rivas, who's the ringleader, walks up to the car and pulls a gun and says, don't know how to tell you this, but we're in the middle of a robbery here. This guy said, what? He said, you're in the middle of a robbery. And the guy said he thought about maybe faking a heart attack or trying to escape, but he was afraid to do it. And Rivas was nice to him, said, look, if you will cooperate, no one's going to get hurt. Took him back in the store. They didn't slap anybody. They didn't hit anybody.
And somebody was hyperventilating
back.
And they were giving
fact,
him.
That was right. When I was hyperventilating, the guy says, look, Michael, just take a deep breath. It's going to be okay. I mean, these guys, it's an amazing robbery when the manager's hyperventilating. One of the robbers says, now, Michael, looks at his name tag, just take a deep breath. It's going to be all right. We're not going to hurt you.
Yeah, I've seen people hyperventilate before. This is how you do this.
And probably other things he was doing, but nonetheless. Those people were, that's not your typical bunch of guys who are out to kill everybody on the street, obviously, the way they treated them. Then the same group of people, a few days later, same bunch, same attitude, come across a policeman. They shoot him 13 different times, 6 times in the head, shot him 4 times in the arm. They hit him 13 bullets that hit him. And then they drag him out of the car and run over him. Now, how why were they so violent to the policeman, and yet on the other hand, so gentle and strange?
The effects of the uniform, maybe?
Nope. Let me tell you what I think it is. And this is something I wish J.C. would have been here to talk about it. My biggest criticism of law enforcement agencies is they do not police their own. Let me give you 2 examples. Let's come this out this week. This past Wednesday, a lawyer came to me with a set of photographs. He had a young client who was an undocumented worker who committed the horrible crime when he was trying to be stopped by the police. He took off in his car. There's a chase. The car ends up in a bio. When he showed me the photographs of this kid that was, they was beat up so badly, I thought he was dead. The photographs show that his eyes were swollen shut. He was on one of those frames they use when someone's had a neck injury, and I thought he was dead. His whole T-shirt was soaked with blood. The deputy sheriff who did the shooting, they took a photograph of his injuries. He had his breeches leg rolled up, and he had 2 scratches below his knee that did not break the skin. Now, they beat the holy hell out of that kid. And what happened, our system, here's how the system works. They filed aggravated assault on the kid who's mutilated. Now, what happens, good cops hide other cops from doing this. They do not police their own. Now, what do you suppose that kid's attitude is going to be toward one in uniform? If, for example, I own a pit bull, which is a bad dog to begin with, or a Doberman, a bad dog to begin with, I chain him up, I put him in a small cage, and I beat him on a regular basis, why should I be shocked if he bites my neighbor? Because policemen, by beating up people, and by good policemen keeping their damn mouth shuts about it, are creating a group of people that have every reason in the world to hate cops. Because that kid who got beat up, you think he's ever going to respect the uniform again? Because here's what our system did. The one that provided the photographs with the sheriff's department gave them to the DA's office. They knew they could look at the photographs. You'd be an idiot to not figure out what happened. And what was their solution? Not to do anything to the cop that mutilated this kid. Their solution was, we'll dismiss the aggravated assault case and we'll give him deferred on the other case.
On the rabbit case.
On the rabbit case. Get him deferred. And that cop should not be on the streets. That cop tonight is out patrolling the streets. He has no business being on the streets and no business carrying a uniform, and no cop should protect him.
Well, you know, I mean, a rabbit from right here in Montrose, a gay guy run out to Stafford, and they found 51 bullet holes in him. There's something about running from cops that get the adrenaline up. And, of course, they said that they thought a can opener on the dash of his truck was a gun.
And see, what makes me angry is that you have, I'm not saying every cop beats up people, but there is no, everybody knows this, cops will not tell on other cops. They will lie like dogs. Let me give you another example. This came up this week. And this is why I'm saying that I'm not saying policemen should die, but I'm not at all surprised it happens. Let me give you an example. There was a case that occurred out in the Pasadena area, and this was just reported this past week as I covered my Wednesday teaching session. A drug dealer's house was broken into in the middle of the day. Because, you know, it's easy to steal from a drug dealer. Hell, he can't call the cops and say, somebody's storing 50 pounds of weed. I got 2 pounds of mushrooms. My God, someone stole them. Plus, there's always cash around.
Yeah.
Call goes to the police station. Burglary in progress. Bunch of deputy sheriffs and the Harris County Sheriff's Department go out there. They go in. They see at the front door, no problem. They go to the back door. Back door is kicked in. They walk inside. Inside the house, they see the whole house torn up. They see some marijuana lying around. Mm-hmm. And they see some, what they call grinders. You need to go radio.
Yeah, we've got Gloria on the line. Gloria?
Yes, I'm here.
What's going on?
Well, the witnesses have come out. Lots of uniformed cops are driving by in their pickup trucks. The execution has taken place. And
they're dispersing?
Well, no, I'm looking down the block. I can see the heads of God. If I was taller, I could probably see more, but at least 50 cops, uniform cops, down at the other end of the block who are being...
Gloria, you've done this often, and when a police officer's alleged assailant is executed, is there usually that many?
Trying to remember the last person that was executed.
Billy Hughes was one.
Yeah, there's usually a number of cops, and the widow of the officer, Hawkins, who was murdered, invited the cops to come, so they did. There's been, God, I don't know, dozens of pickup trucks drive by with different, like Garland and some of the Dallas suburbs,
uh-huh,
police departments written on their trucks. So, yeah, I've never noticed that the prison system has put up canopies for them to stand under. But I guess the heat was too much for them today. But we had a good crowd of people protesting. About 20 people were here. And a couple of young African-Americans who live here in Huntsville decided to come out. They said at school people were always talking about these executions, so they came out here to see what really happened. Yeah, the people who officiated are starting to drive off the prison properties.
We'll take the opportunity to gather everybody's email, and we'll all stay in touch.
Okay.
Thank you, Gloria.
All right. Thank you, Ray. Bye-bye.
And that was Gloria Ruback, reporter from KPFT, frequent guest on the prison show. And we're going to, Jim, can you finish your thought?
Yeah, let me tell you what I was talking about. This drug dealer's house was burglarized, and what happened, once they went inside and saw the marijuana, saw some paraphernalia, and saw some equipment to grind up the marijuana, they looked around the house, and they're permitted to do that, and they looked to make sure, and you could tell they'd been coached carefully, but they said, we looked in only places where burglars could have been. They claimed they all then left the house, which the law requires them to do. The law then requires them to get a search warrant. So they call their supervisor, and they testify. They call their supervisor to get a warrant. And they testified during the period of time that all of them took the oath. There's several policemen standing outside the house. They all took an oath to tell the truth. And they said during that intervening period of time, we didn't re-enter the house until the warrant was there. unbeknownst to them, the drug dealer had installed a video camera at the rear door, and the dummies didn't see it. And the video camera showed that during the time that they were going to get a warrant, that several deputies go past the video camera into the house wearing latex gloves. Now, why are they wearing latex gloves? They don't do a prostate examination. Yeah. They wear latex gloves when they're conducting a search. It also showed one of the deputy sheriffs coming out with a camera bag in his hand. Everybody in the courthouse knew they were lying and not telling the truth. The judge knew they were lying and not telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And what happened, how our wonderful Court of Appeals handled that, they said, well, the camera didn't show them doing any searching. They knew they were lying. Remember what Dershowitz said in his book on criminal defense? There's the Ten Commandments. First Commandments, cops always lie. Second Commandment, judge and prosecutors know they lie and don't give a damn. Now, when you start permitting a system that tolerates policemen who beat up people and abuse people, when you tolerate a system that permits cops to lie under oath and not be outraged by it, when you permit a system that they put people in prison and beat the hell out of them and make them angry, then they get out and act as shock because they hate a cop or want to kill a cop. Let me be honest with you. When I see all these real, they have all these big caravans when a policeman dies and all the cops go by bringing their sirens, it doesn't bring a tear to my eye. I think what the skunk said when the wind changed, it all comes back to me now. And I think that they have and I think every policeman that's ever beat a prisoner, every policeman who hit a cop who believed the prisoner should share some responsibility and guilt for this police officer dying because he paid a price for what they created or helped to create. And that we've never talked about.
So police behavior is itself a safety issue for their brethren?
Well, you know, if they want to really be safe, the same thing, go back to my dog analogy. If I love my neighbor, I'm not going to get a bad dog and beat it and then turn it loose. If I really care for my neighbor and my fellow man.
Attorney Jim Skelton gives an opinion. We are joined now by Brian Olson. Brian, what's your title with a CO union?
My name is Brian Olson. I'm executive director of AFSCME, the Correctional Employees Council. That stands for American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union. We are the union for the state correctional employees in the state of Texas.
Brian, we had a fellow executed tonight. He was a volunteer. He didn't exercise any appeals, and he was ready to go, and he went. But this grows out of an escape situation.
Yes, I was familiar with that.
And I would imagine in your neighborhood this has been discussed at great length. What are people saying about staffing problems and other things that may have contributed to an escape boldness?
Excuse me, contributed to a what?
The boldness of these guys to escape.
Oh, well, a lot of it comes back to the understaffing and the agency having trouble finding people to fill the positions of correctional officer in the state of Texas. They've had such large turnover that it's been very difficult for the agency, considering in Texas, where the correctional officers are 48th in the country in pay, and the largest prison system in the country now, bigger than California, I believe.
Oh, yeah, Texas. I'm Ray Hill. I do the prison show here anyway. And I'm a former inmate, and I used to work in maintenance.
We look at it like this, you know, the more professional the officers are, the more education they have, the better pay to make them more of a professional standard, then the safer the inmates are as well. And the families can, actually the Inmate Family Association support pay raises for correctional employees, and they've been very supportive of us.
Well, actually,
this is strange bedfellows, but they believe if the workforce is more educated and better paid, the more professional they'll be.
Actually, the Ruiz case and every other prison reform case that I've ever experienced call for more guards, more employees.
Very, very understaffed. Yesterday, we got word that Brad Livingston has presented a proposal to the board of directors for TDCJ, which will in turn go to the legislature starting in January, asking for a 20% pay raise for correctional officers.
What?
So this is significant. And we've been asking for this for years and years. I started this union with some other staff that I have 17 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to now see the fruition of our hard work and testifying and working in the trenches trying to get the politicians and the agency to understand, until you get up to a professional pay level, you're not going to be professional. Now, I'm not saying that correctional officers today are not professional. I'm just saying that a lot of them don't want to stay very long because of the pay.
You have an enormous turnover.
And it's a tough place to work. As you well know, it's not air-conditioned in these prisons. In the administrative offices, they are. But then the prisoners and the correctional officers working in a very tough environment, you know, sometimes upwards of 120, 130 degrees. Tough place to be when you're not making very good pay, and you could go to a fast food chain and make more money. So it's now incumbent upon me and us as a union to sell this to the state legislature, because the turnover is rampant for correctional officers, and that costs the state money.
Well, in addition,
it costs the state a lot of money every year having to rehire and retrain people. It costs millions to do that. So we say, put the money, don't build new prisons, put it into the building of the infrastructure of the agency again, and in the pay, in the education of the correctional officers. And it's starting to pay off. All the drum beating and head bashing we've done, finally, Brad Livingston's actually what we consider thinking outside the box. And it's the first time I think a director's done that in my recollection.
Yeah,
he's going to tough it up and go to legislature and say, hey, because they've asked him in the past, what do you need? Tell us what you need. Tell us what you want. Now he's finally opening up and saying, this is what we have to have to survive.
Let me tell the listeners that Brad Livingston is the executive director of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice.
Yes.
Then you got another boss by the name of Quarterman, who is the director of the institutional division. But I wanted to ask you, in addition to your responsibilities with AFSCME, do you actually work on a unit?
No. I used to be a parole officer, and before that I was a correctional officer, but that was over 20 years ago.
Okay.
But I have worked for GDCJ, and I have worked as a correctional officer, so I know their plight. And I've gone to enough employee disciplinary hearings and grievance hearings and gone outside these facilities and leafleted and talked to these correctional officers to know the basic things that they need. And pay is one of them. There's some other issues that need to be dealt with, though, in the future.
This Conley escape is a pretty famous event in the memory of people who actually worked there. Do you actually see some reason to conclude that understaffing played a role in that escape?
Oh, absolutely. Back then, it was really starting to become a problem. And some of the people that were working on the unit at the time were so new, they weren't seasoned veterans. And, I mean, some of them only been there a few months. So it just showed with a massive turnover. The training they get is good with the agency, but it's just not enough. It takes, and you know this, that it takes years for a veteran officer to actually become a veteran who knows what they're doing and is very competent. It's a tough job. It takes a long time to learn. And because they were so short-staffed, they didn't have the veterans in the positions they needed. They just had some new people working that, I mean, hadn't been there very long. And, Aubrey Hawkins was a course murderer, and I got to know his mother very well. And it was a tragedy. I spoke to her many times and prayed with her to try and get her through her hard times. But, I was involved in it, certainly.
Brian Olson, thank you very much for joining us on Texas Execution Watch. I look forward to seeing you in Austin working on those raises after the first of the year.
And I thank you, and I appreciate you giving me the time to be on here, and I really like your show.
Thank you, sir.
You bet.
And that was Brian Olson, and he is the representative of the executive director of the AFSCME Union of Correctional Officers. How do convicts and officers really get along?
I want to answer two questions, and it'll correspond with the question you just asked. Jim, when
we're talking, this is Jim Sinclair.
Billy Sinclair.
Billy Sinclair.
Earlier, Mr. Hauser was talking about his first question was, how did this escape happen? And Jim was talking about the attitude of the inmates once they were out and pulled their first robbery. Most prisons will get the very best and even the most long-term inmates assigned to maintenance. These are skill positions. And if you get a man, an inmate that is trained in a particular skill, whether it's carpentry, welding, or any kind of
plumbing,
whatever it is,
electrical,
you want him to be there, and you want him to be there for a while. Well, of course, these inmates are moving all over the prison, so it's very easy for them to observe and understand the security operations. They become intimately familiar not only with the operations, but with the staff, and they enjoy a great deal of trust and movement. Well, as a result of all their interactions, because in a lot of respects, a lot of times, they're almost like quasi-official guards.
Sure.
They go in there and they have the authority to say, I'm here to fix the toilet. I'm here to fix this lock on his cell door.
Knock on the door, yeah, and the warden's wife will open the house.
Exactly. And so, you know, they have a lot of freedom of movement. But as a result of this very close interaction with the staff, they develop a personality that was manifested when they engaged in that first robbery, to be nice, to be considerate, to be conciliatory to the people that they were taking their money from. This is what they had learned. Now, Jim made a very good point. But don't let this belie the fact that these are very desperate men. And I think when this young officer pulled up on this scene, and he was probably shot initially inside of his vehicle.
Yeah.
And then when they pulled him out of the vehicle and shot him five or six more times. I don't know exactly how many times they shot him, but he was shot outside. I would not be a bit surprised at each one of these guys, because they're in a pack. They're in a group. They say, if one of us go down, we're all going to go down for the same thing.
So they all bought the ticket.
So I think they all fired a shot.
Bought the ticket.
They all bought the ticket, just like you said, because when you're committed like that, this wasn't done overnight. This plan was not done overnight. These guys worked together. They were very close. They were very synchronized in their emotions and the way they looked at life. And so when it come down and they realized they killed a cop, all of them were buying into the death penalty, and they knew it. And that's why they all took a shot. And I believe that's what happened that night. I don't have no proof of that, but that's what I believe at.
Is that consistent with your understanding of inmate behavior?
Yes, it's my consistent with that group of that kind of inmates who are long-term inmates. Very desperate. They worked the system well. They got into the job that they needed to get into. They understood the security operations. They knew what they had to do to get out. And this was a very well thought out, very well executed escape. This had nothing to do with staffing. I beg to differ, Mr. Olson. This had absolutely nothing to do with staff shortage. This had to do with inmates. They would have escaped if they had had every man position in that prison field that day, because they had a plan.
Well, I mean, aren't we talking about Mr. Olson and J.C. and Mr. Skelton and you and I looking at this elephant with what's in our view? And
you've got
somebody up at the trunk.
Yeah.
Mr. Olson saying, you know, it's to my advantage to blame all escapes. Staff, exactly.
I understand what Mr. Olson's
doing. J.C. talking about the brotherhood and all of that, because that's where he has.
Yeah.
You and I talking about the inmates from 11. And Jim, I got a question for you.
Sure.
I went to Texas prison sentence to 160 years. Billy here went to prison to death row. We were both in hopeless situations.
Not too hopeless, because you both got out.
We both got out, but looking at it from the other end, I'm looking down the barrel of 160 years. My idea of a survival is, how do I live here for the rest of my life? And instead of going another direction, looking for a way to escape, I hadn't been there 6 weeks till I had the keys to a truck in my hand and I could drive anywhere and always came back. So the situation is that every person then reacts differently to these circumstances.
Sure.
Just like every lawyer reacts differently to the cases that they get.
Of course.
And so the situation is, I see this guy. If I were 38 years old and I'd rolled the dice on an escape and that had failed, I wouldn't be talking to no lawyers about appeal. I'd shot my craps and unfortunately came back snake eyes. Boxcars maybe, or something else.
Well, one thing you got to realize about this guy, he was not your average convict on death row.
He's bright.
For one, well, Rivas, I mean, Rivas was considered the bright one, but Rodriguez, for example, what he basically did, and you really can't blame him, he shot his wife because she got fat.
Yeah.
Now, the reason he went to the jail
and the insurance money.
Yeah. When he went to the jail and his wife became a vegetarian, got fat, and he wanted to get rid of her. So what he did, he was going to college and met this real cute girl that wasn't fat and wasn't a vegetarian. Real simple. So he started writing love notes back and forth to her. Well, he got to go home and look at this fat cow at the house. He got kind of tired of that. And I can understand that. Wouldn't eat free
meat. Anyway, his brother was
a doctor. Yeah, that's right. He'd eat vegetables and carrots and grain, weight like a fat cow, and he got tired of it. So he had another brother who was a drug dealer. So they said, you know, we got 150,000 two policies on this fat bitch. Let's get rid of her and get us some dough. So what they did, they started plotting to get rid of this fat cow. And so the brother was a cocaine dealer. So
pretty
he knew,
tough fellow.
Yeah.
You're San Antonio. You got to be tough to be in a low-end cocaine business.
Well, he knew a guy that didn't like fat girls, too, and didn't like vegetarians. So they said, we'll hire this fool to get
a gun.
That's right. We had 300,000 bucks sitting out there. We get rid of this fat vegetarian cow. We have 300,000 bucks. So what they did, they paid this fool $2,000, you know, to shoot the fat woman, all right? So that's what happened. The first time they planned to shoot her, they were going to go to a movie, and they kind of chickened out. I guess it was a Clint East movie, and they got scared. So she came
No, that's security guard.
Yeah, security guard at the restaurant, that's right. Come back home, and they shoot the fat woman. And then the big mistake the dummy made after she dies the day of the funeral, he goes out partying and doing mariachi music and doing ay-ay-ay and shooting tequila and eating meat after the killing. And so the cops think that's odd behavior for a guy who just shot his fat wife. His fat wife is dead. She's not in the ground, you know, decaying yet. And here she is, you know. So what happened is that they got onto him and then knew his brother was a drug dealer, leaned on this one of his client, the guy that did the killing, confessed and then went up the chain and got this guy.
And all this happened in 3 or 4 days in San Antonio.
And what he really basically has said, like I say, he went to a Catholic school, had a good business, just had a fat wife he didn't like. That's basically it.
He went to college.
Yeah. And so what happened, he sent what he's been saying consistently, look, I've messed up. I hold myself accountable. I got to pay for what I did. And that's what he's basically been saying. You know, I shouldn't have killed my wife, and I knew when I got in this escape attempt and the officer was killed, I should accept the responsibility for my conduct. I shouldn't be shooting fat women and being a part of a group that kills a policeman. And I accept my responsibility. I'm going to die for it and quit whining about it. That's what he's basically has said, which is a cut above your average person in prison and on death row. And in law, even in the law business.
Compared to the guy that was executed last Tuesday.
The guy executed last Tuesday ought to be kind of happy about that, right? I hate to tell you, but you don't want that guy Dorsey out running around the streets.
Well, you know, I understand.
Even skinny women are in danger. He's out.
I mean, Dorsey's situation was entirely different.
Absolutely.
Dorsey was a pretty bad dude.
Tell me. When you start, you know, burning your babysitter's house and, you know, shooting, stabbing kids on your peewee team? Yeah, I would say so.
And so this guy was showing some ambition. He seemed to be going somewhere.
See, it's his wife's fault. She shouldn't have gained all that weight and become a vegetarian. She'd been alive.
Or it was that temptress in school.
Oh, it's the woman's fault. See,
but in any case, it's the woman's fault.
Yeah, of course. That and Republicans. You're absolutely right.
That,
and Baptist preachers.
That's the guilty parties here. No, we're somewhat lighthearted here this evening, but there's a joke under the surface here that's going on that you're not aware of, listeners. My name is Ray Hill. This is Texas Execution Watch. They just killed a man, and he was a volunteer. There was no effort to make application for clemency. There was no pending appeals in this case. Jim, what were you able to find out about the appeals in the co-defendants' cases?
The only really issue, in fact, this is one of those where they published nothing. They just said kind of wham, bam, thank you, man. And the only issue at mitigation, there was a special report or some investigative report the police did in which and checking out these guys, they had a graduate scale on who was the baddest of all, who was the worst, and that guy George Rebus was the one at the top of the list and went down to a graduating order who was less culpable, who was less responsible. And they tried to get that record in. Those, other than Rebus, of course, wanted it out. But all those defendants other than Rebus who were at the mitigation, at the punishment hearing, wanted that document in to kind of take some of their blameworthiness away. And that document was not admitted. And that's about the only issue they had on appeal. There's no parties problem
there's,
that came
there's
up.
There's nothing really written about on the appeals. It just kind of wrote unwritten opinion, pass it on.
Well, here's what happens. When a guy like him, see, our Constitution gives you the right to be an idiot. You have that every right in the world. You can waive your right to counsel. You can waive your appeal. When that occurs, all you're going to have is a hearing in front of a judge to see if you're competent and able to do that. That normally is not published anywhere. Mm-hmm. So in this case involving Rodriguez, the only thing they're going to have at any type of trial hearing is some psychiatrist talking to him and having a hearing to see if he's competent, knows exactly what he's doing. He's not some wacko that's giving up his right to appeal. And after looking at him, they said, you know, you're rational, you can do what you want to. That's never published, so you have no way of knowing about that. There's never an opinion or appeal. Because who's going to appeal it? He's not going to appeal it because he wants to die. And the state's not going to appeal it because they agree with the courts. You'll have nothing written. You have a written opinion.
There is no adversary here.
No, not really.
I think that it rings true to me. Billy said earlier, Billy Sinclair said earlier, about everybody buying a ticket for the ride. And that may be the reason there's so many bullet holes in the victim, is that we're all in this together and we're going to all go down together. Rebus, clearly from all reports, was the ringleader in this overall thing. And when they finally got to Colorado, they got to the camp. One of them took time out to go to Bible study for a little prayer group there in the camp, and they were having Bible study. So he went over to participate in that, which is very convict-like behavior. And we're looking at this. By the way, an update on the Dorsey execution. We had received a report earlier that Dorsey had put it out that he was going to fight them on the way to the chamber, and he was not going to go quietly to the chamber. There has not been any report from any of the witnesses that actually happened, his behavior in the chamber that had witnesses was such that his cooperation was as with all other inmates. One of the things about the show, we're on HD Channel 2. Certainly, Texas Death Row is within hearing distance of KPFT's regular broadcast. And I received mail today that they have tweaked the antenna system at the Polunsky unit in Livingston. So whenever I do the prison show tomorrow night, the people on death row are getting a better signal than they get now. What we are saying here does not reach and is not shared with people on death row in Texas because they simply can't get the signal. They don't have this kind of radio. If you're listening to this radio show, you either have an HD radio that you have gotten as a premium from another radio station, or you're listening to us over the Internet. And we're going to continue to be at the location where you hear us tonight. We will be back next week, Wednesday and Thursday. We have two more executions next week. If you can hear the signal, you're listening to it because radio station KPFT provides this HD airtime for us to come in and watch Texas executions. It is produced by Elizabeth Stein, our electronic wizard, and co-producer for the technical end of it is Otis McClay. I want to thank Jim Skelton and Billy Sinclair for coming in and joining us. And tonight we had guests J.C. Mosier and Brian Olson. And we will be back the next time we do this. My name is Ray Hill. Good night.